Now, Bruce, I'm a bit trepidatious about talking to you this week because last week, right in the middle of our chat, you were bodily abducted by aliens. Are your feet firmly on the ground?
Well, they are, and you know, I had a talk with those aliens ahead of time, and to be compassionate, it was the QAnon aliens, and they needed some help recalibrating their Jewish space lasers. So we just, you know, fixed it. It's all good. We're here.
Now, talking about fixing things, the Khashoggi report, please, and Joe's rather vacillating response.
Well, this is really fascinating. Of course, one of Joe Biden's campaign promises was to release the CIA's assessment on the assassination, brutal killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, Washington Post columnist. And he did so. He kept that promise last week with a short but clear and brutal CIA assessment. That responsibility for Khashoggi's killing lay clearly with the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, and the various actors around him. And it laid out all the reasons for that. It made it clear, not that further evidence was really needed, but it made it clear that this was a deliberate Saudi government plan supported by the Crown Prince had probably ordered and approved by him.
So now, that Joe must have whacked in some huge sanctions or, you know, some very severe punishment.
Right. You would think, right? But in fact, no sanctions directed at MBS, no great change in the America's relationship with Saudi Arabia. We're going ahead with military aid and other kinds of stuff. You know, Anthony Blinken, the new Secretary of State, made it clear that Saudi Arabia, in his view and in the administration's view, remains a central partner in the Middle East, and that he put it in terms of more subtle means of pressure, read really nothing, wrist slap and nothing. I mean, there was some symbolic stuff when Joe Biden made his first official phone call to Saudi Arabia last week. It was to the king, the 85-year-old king, not to MBS. It's pretty clear that MBS is not going to get a visa to the U.S. anytime soon. But the reality for this administration is that conventional mainstream politics in the Mideast will say that Saudi Arabia remains a critical ally against Iran, remains a partner in all kinds of ways, so that both the Khashoggi killing and the war in Yemen remain, on the one hand, areas in which the U.S. will criticize Saudi Arabia, but not go so far. And in fact, it's interesting. We're actually going to see NGOs, I think, try to carry the ball further rather than the government. Yesterday, RSF, Reporters Sans Frontières, Reporters Without Borders filed a criminal complaint in Germany accusing MBS and the Saudi government of crimes against humanity in Khashoggi's killing under the extraterritorial jurisdiction laws of Germany. That is likely to have a far bigger effect in the long run than anything Joe Biden is likely to do. This is an administration with a foreign policy hewing closely to America's cautious approach with Saudi Arabia in the past.
Now, COVID continues to carve its terrible sway through your country. A relief bill has sailed through Congress. It's what, $1.9 trillion COVID relief package. What's in it, Bruce?
Well, it's sailed through the House and it's awaiting action, final action by the Senate. On the one hand, what's in it is fascinating. It's huge and ambitious. It's got money for schools and the reopening of schools. It's got lots of money for local governments and state governments, which have been bearing the brunt of distribution of the vaccine and of paying for treatment for the poor and so on. So it's got lots and lots of that kind of aid, and it's by far the single most ambitious stimulus bill in generations. For example, back in 2008, when we had the worst economic crisis since the Depression, and the new President Obama walked into that, he spent $800 billion. And at that time, that felt like a lot of money. It was criticized roundly by Republicans for years. This is more than double that. This is $1.9 trillion. And what's astonishing is that it remains tremendously popular. 60-70% of the public in all kinds of polls show support for this. So we're seeing symbolic opposition from Republicans. They're not going to vote for it, but they're not really fighting it. What's interesting, however, is what is almost certainly not going to be in the bill. The call to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, which was included in the House version and is championed in the Senate by Bernie Sanders, was ruled off the table this week. Usually big civil rights bills or big wage bills get votes in the House. This was a vote of one. There's a Senate parliamentarian, a nonpartisan official, and she ruled that this provision of the Senate bill doesn't meet the rules for this complex budget process called reconciliation, which is the way that Democrats in the Senate are looking to push through the relief package without Republican votes. It's moved off the table. And, theoretically, the Biden administration or the Senate majority, the Democrats could ignore this, could challenge it. It's an advisory opinion. But the Biden White House has made it clear that it's not going to challenge the parliamentarian's ruling. And this sort of solves a political problem for Joe Biden because moderates in the Democratic Party, most particularly Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia, who is the 50th vote in the 50-50 majority, made it clear that he didn't want to support this big minimum wage increase, more than doubling it from $7 an hour, the last minimum wage increase in 2009. So because of one senator and one parliamentarian, we're not going to get the minimum wage this time around.
It seems only yesterday you and I and the whole world was celebrating the efforts of the governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, in the pandemic. And in fact, that effervescent commentator, Randy Rainbow, declared himself a Cuomo-sexual. He's not doing so well at the moment.
The words Cuomo and sexual are not two words that you want to be putting together right now. Just a few weeks ago, you and I were talking about other problems Cuomo was having, particularly around COVID-19, the revelation that he had
cooked the books
on nursing home deaths early in the pandemic at the very moment that he was enjoying such national celebrity. But over the course of the last week, his situation has gotten much worse. Three women, the latest just last night, who worked for him in various ways, have come forward with allegations of sexual harassment, proposition type comments, of hands on bare backs, of all kinds of unwanted contact, and more broadly, the kind of something that's been public, an open secret, but that now takes on new meaning in light of these allegations, which is a really bullying and hostile atmosphere in the governor's office. And these sexual harassment allegations are being taken very seriously by other Democrats. Letitia James, the Democratic Attorney General of New York, is going to appoint an independent investigator. The Biden administration has been kind of really put some distance between itself and Cuomo on this. This is a guy, you have to remember, who is very powerful, who has been in office since 2011 in a state with no term limits on the governor. But there is real doubt now whether he will be able to survive this. There's a long line of people, probably who are going to come forward. I think these three allegations are probably just the beginning of a cascade.
Well, I've got some good news because I'm now going to refer to a gentleman with an impeccable record of good sexual conduct, and that is, of course, Donald Trump. And my happiness knows no bounds because he's alerted us, warned us, that he's starting to plan for a second term.
Well, as if there was any doubt, the Conservative Political Action Committee, CPAC, had its big annual confab in Orlando, Florida. Trump gave the first notable speech since he left office, and made it clear that he's inclined to run again. Whether or not he is actually going to run, he clearly wants to own the Republican Party, wants to own the Republican field, and no better place to try that out than at CPAC, which at one time was a place of intellectual ferment and a kind of gathering place for the multiple factions of American conservatism, but now over the last few years has been converted into a wholly owned subsidiary of Trumpism and Trump Incorporated. The whole culture of CPAC is now fully in the Trump camp. And, at this point, this is the faction that owns the Republican Party, and the moderates like Mitt Romney or Susan Collins may envision themselves someday having the party back. But at this point, you've got to say that it's in the Trumpists' hands. And the rhetoric this weekend was undiminished. The lies and misrepresentation about the election were undiminished. Nothing in the last month seems to have moderated or modified the former president's approach.
And a majority of Republicans are still lapping it up.
A majority of Republicans are still lapping it up, or would still support the president, though, 4 years out in a primary, that's not a meaningful statement. It also needs to be said that the voter registration statistics coming out of this last election show that, as has already a trend that already began, has been accelerating, which is a lot of voters leaving the Republican Party and becoming independent and unaffiliated. Indeed, in many places now, unaffiliated voters are becoming a major faction. It's true that the Republican Party supports Trump, but it's also true that it's a smaller, narrower, less dominant Republican Party than any we've seen in generations.
Bruce, would you pass on my best wishes to the aliens? They are now free to bodily abduct you and perform whatever experiments on your body that they wish to do. I've been talking, and we got through the whole segment without a disaster, to Bruce Shapiro, columnist with The Nation and, of course, exec director of the Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma at Columbia University.